It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Voters across northern Wisconsin head back to the polls Tuesday in a special election. The 7th Congressional District has been unrepresented since Republican Sean Duffy resigned from his U.S. House seat in September. Do you live in northern Wisconsin? Who is your favorite candidate to win Tuesday's election? Are you voting Democratic or Republican? Join in now, 800-642-1234. Rob Mintzer is WPR's rural communities reporter based in Wausau, and he's been covering this special election. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, Kate. Thanks.
So let's look at the candidates here. We have Republican State Senator Tom Tiffany and Democrat Tricia Zunker, who's the Wausau School Board president and a Ho-Chunk Supreme Court justice. So let us start with Tom Tiffany. Can you tell us about his candidacy here?
Sure. Tiffany has been in the state Senate since 2013. He was a couple years before that. He was elected to the state assembly in 2011. And he spent about 20 years with his wife running a river cruise for tourists in Oneida County. So he's a northern Wisconsin guy. In the state legislature, he's been, he has actually led on some of the like conservative pushes during the Walker administration. He was the lead sponsor of a bill that deregulated mining in Wisconsin. That was an attempt to try to bring this massive open pit sulfide mine to the Northwoods. That didn't end up happening, but that was like an example of the sort of one of the highest profile legislative pushes that he was part of in the legislature.
What themes have come up in his campaign?
Well, so he has this this legislative history in Wisconsin, but this campaign, the theme can be summarized in one word, which is Trump. He has it's a conservative district. This is a northern Wisconsin a district, and voted overwhelmingly for Trump in 2016. And so his campaign for Congress has been based on his promising to be a close ally and strong supporter of the president. He's received the president's endorsement on Twitter and has touted that a lot. And that's really like, I think, the main campaign theme that he's hit over and over.
What can you tell us about his competitor, Democrat Tricia Zunker?
Well, so Tricia Zunker, who is a Wausau native, is the Wausau School Board president and is a Ho-Chunk Supreme Court justice. She would be the first Native American woman elected from Wisconsin to Congress, the first Native American of any gender elected to Congress from Wisconsin. And so there's this this historic nature to the candidacy that I think has gotten a lot of attention to her candidacy, including national attention. She's gotten, endorsements from Elizabeth Warren and a number of sort of left-leaning celebrities. Also, that, of course, is because people are very, very interested in Wisconsin this year. And that's one thing about this race is that people are going to be looking for any sign of what the special election on Tuesday, what it might mean for November.
Yeah. What is her platform? What is she running on?
So she's emphasizing stewardship of the environment and sort of traditionally democratic issues. But she really hit hard healthcare as an issue in a way that has probably become maybe more salient in recent weeks as the COVID-19 pandemic. So she talks about Tiffany, who favors repeal of the Affordable Care Act, which would take away people's protections for pre-existing conditions. She's hit that hard as a theme, and in general, talks a lot about trying to support small businesses and small farms in this economic downturn.
We're talking about Tuesday's congressional election in northern Wisconsin, and we have Rob Mintzer with us. He's WPR's rural communities reporter, has been covering this race. What questions do you have about the candidates, Tom Tiffany and Tricia Zunker? What issues matter to you in this election? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Chris now in Port Wing with a question. Hi, Chris.
Hi, I just am very concerned about the influence of outside super PAC money. We've been watching this for the last several election cycles, and very, very wealthy individuals like the Koch brothers have been funding the Club for Growth Action and American for Prosperity from outside the state, coming in with literally millions of dollars funding candidates like Tom Tiffany. I'm looking at one of his Club for Growth advertisements right now. It's very disturbing to have our elections influenced by outside billionaires when it's so important that we get good representation for the Northland from the voters of the Northland. And I do think Ms. Zunker is a better choice for the 7th District.
Chris, thanks for calling in. Rob, what do you notice on campaign spending in this race?
Tiffany has outraised Zunker considerably, though Zunker has had more fundraising than any Democrat in this district has had in quite some time. It is certainly a fact that conservative super PACs are supporting Tiffany, and actually Americans for Prosperity has been he's been a close ally of Americans for Prosperity for years as a state legislator as well. Just for what it's worth, I mean, it's not the same, but to be fair, a great deal of Trisha Zunker's support has come from out of state. They tend to, her average donations are much, much smaller than Tiffany's. She's getting a lot of sort of online donors. But it is also the case that because there's a national spotlight on this race, both candidates have gotten support from out of the district.
WPR had hosted a candidate debate Monday night. What were your takeaways from that debate?
It seems clear that Tom Tiffany's campaign strategy is to really highlight sort of traditional red meat conservative issues at this point. He is trying to activate the conservative base in the district. So he spent a lot of time in the debate talking about Zunker's positions on immigration or gun rights. And Zunker's task, I think, is to try to steer away from those traditional conservative issues and try to talk more about healthcare and issues that where a Democrat might have more of an advantage.
Did the candidates address at all the state's safer at home orders or social distancing going on?
Yeah, I mean, there's a sort of emerging partisan split here. When it comes to this issue, you see it in the state legislature, and we see it in this race too. Tiffany is supportive of a more regional approach to opening up, and Zunker takes the line that coronavirus does not stop at a county line, and that approach is too risky at this point.
Rob, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you.
Rob Mentzer is Wisconsin Public Radio's rural communities reporter based in Wausau. We've been talking about the 7th Congressional District election and Monday's debate hosted by WPR. That debate is scheduled to be rebroadcast on Friday on our central, western, and northern Wisconsin stations. Check your station program schedules for times. Coming up, two advocates for survivors of domestic and sexual abuse explain their work during the pandemic. For weeks, national groups have raised alarm bells about higher rates of abuse as more families stay home from work or school. What questions do you have about curbing abuse in Wisconsin? What do you want to know? Be part of this 800-642-1234. We'll be back to the discussion in a minute here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about domestic abuse and sexual violence during the coronavirus pandemic. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And a word of caution here, this conversation may be triggering at times for survivors, so please take care. Concerns about a rise in domestic violence and child abuse have been widely reported since shelter-in-place orders took effect. Last month, Carmen Petrie told WPR that the Sojourner Family Peace Center in Milwaukee was receiving more calls from police and case referrals.
Definitely, violence continues to be happening at a high rate, and our fear is that it will continue to escalate.
Do you work for an organization that provides services to survivors? What have you noticed since the pandemic? Are you a survivor of abuse? How are you doing now? We're at 800-642-1234. Grisel Santiago-Rivera is Interim Executive Director of End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. Grisel, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kaden. Thanks for having me over.
And we have Kelly Molitke here, Associate Director of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Kelly, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's look at the situation, Kelly, first with survivors. What are you noticing during the pandemic?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the main message we want to get out to survivors is that service providers around the state remain open, and we're hearing lots of different reports about how the pandemic is impacting survivors' ability to reach out. But it's most important that that survivors hear the message and know that services are available in their local community.
So under the governor's Safer at Home order, can people leave home to receive services right now? Services from, like, your Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault?
Yeah, I think for the most part right now, a lot of programs are trying to provide as many services as they can remotely. So following the stay-at-home orders, so programs are being creative, like everybody is right now, to find ways to provide remote support groups and hotline-based, phone-based services. But yes, if people need to leave in order to be safe to access services, they absolutely should do that.
Grisel, what are you seeing from your vantage point at End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin? What are you noticing during the pandemic?
So we are noticing in some areas an increase in police calls, especially Milwaukee and Waukesha County have reported increases of approximately 30% in police calls. And of course, you know, just like Kelly said, we are noticing that programs are providing services remotely. We are doing our best to provide some support to programs to be able to do that. And, you know, survivors are still trying to get services. But the reality also that we're seeing is that we know that a lot of survivors are actually not able to do that, because by being at home, that is not a safe place for them to be able to make those calls, and some of their support systems have been cut off by the fact that they have to stay at home.
Because you can't be connect, or you can't get out to talk with that friend or that colleague or someone, a loved one who could help you in person right now. Is that right, Grisel?
That is correct. And also, due to the Safer at Home order, a lot of survivors and victims have lost their jobs. And the main connection that they had to the outside world was their ability to go out and work. And unfortunately, those who lost their jobs don't have those contacts anymore.
We're discussing domestic abuse and sexual violence during the pandemic and how Wisconsin organizations are responding. Grisel Santiago-Rivera is with End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin, and Kelly Molitke is here. She's with the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault. You can join in with your questions. What do you want to know from advocates about curbing domestic abuse and sexual violence in Wisconsin? Do you work for an organization that provides services to survivors? How have your services been affected by the pandemic? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Kelly, hospitals are oftentimes the entry point for people getting connected with services. Is that happening less often right now due to the pandemic?
That's a great question. Yeah, we have heard anecdotally that survivor reports for medical and forensic exams have decreased, possibly due to the barriers or fear that survivors may have in accessing health services. It's, you know, normally too, an advocate will be able to meet a survivor at a hospital to provide support during an examination. And that access has been limited, understandably, as hospital systems are changing their protocols and responses during the pandemic.
Do we know that nurse forensic exams are taking place at hospitals right now, or is that a bit fuzzy?
No, we know that those services are still available, and we've been hearing that from across the state. Our concern is that we're also hearing that the requests for services have decreased in many areas.
Griselle, are hospitals allowing advocates to go with to help survivors during these exams?
So my understanding is that some hospitals have created a way for advocates to still be able to be present, even if they're not necessarily in the room with victims. So sometimes that means being on the phone and still providing that support for victims. So I believe hospitals are trying to work with victims and with service providers. Again, it is a matter of balancing the safety of everybody during the pandemic with the services that advocates have to provide for victims.
You mentioned an uptick in police calls. Are you seeing differences during the pandemic in how police respond to reports of domestic violence, Griselle?
So what we hear from advocates across the state is that it varies. I think that there are some counties that are reporting that the police are responding, but their response is a little different. As you know, probably know, we have mandatory arrest laws in Wisconsin for domestic abuse cases. So we hear from some places that the police are not arresting. And some of that may be due to fear of, you know, having somebody who may be infected in your squad car or something like that. But I think the police are really trying to respond in a different way when those calls come in, domestic abuse calls come in, to make sure that victims continue to be safe.
And Kelly, what are you noticing in the response of police to sexual assault calls?
We haven't actually heard a whole lot related to that because the response does look quite different for sexual assault than domestic violence. What we have been hearing is more about the criminal justice system broadly. So the pandemic has caused delays in the criminal justice system, whether that's for, you know, pretrial hearings and different things like that. And that process is already lengthy and exhaustive for survivors. So it's causing more delays that, of course, impact survivors.
Yeah, Kelly, if a trial is being pushed back for weeks or perhaps even months because of the pandemic, what does that mean for survivors?
I think it just delays their ability to seek justice, whatever that might look like for them. And as we all can appreciate right now, too, any disruption in our schedules cause us some level of anxiety. And so imagine that now as a survivor, and those delays are in your the case that's going forward against the perpetrator of violence. And so I think, of course, that's going to have an emotional toll on survivors the longer that gets delayed, and the uncertainty of when it will happen. You know, so if it's just getting delayed and there's not real clarity, I think that can also increase anxiety.
Griselle, are people still able to file restraining orders or other, you know, court matters in this world we're living in right now? What are restraining orders like right now?
So, yes, they are. A few years ago, the Wisconsin court system created an electronic filing system that is available to everybody. And a lot of counties are allowing all of the restraining order cases to be filed electronically. And so advocates have been assisting a lot of victims doing that. Now, the issue with that is most hearings are also happening virtually, so either by phone, by Zoom, or some other fashion, and that could create an impact as to how the case gets resolved, especially because if somebody is a if a victim happens to be in a place that is not safe, or if they don't have the technology to actually reach the court system, then they're not really able to meaningfully participate in those hearings. So advocates are doing a lot of work, domestic violence advocates across the state, a lot of work to support those that need to file restraining orders.
Grisel Santiago-Rivera there from End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. We have Kelly Molitke here as well from the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Have you ever called a hotline for help? What were you seeking and did you get the help that you needed? How do you think survivors of abuse could be better supported in Wisconsin? Do you feel safe at home? Be part of this conversation at 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this in just a moment after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. First, a big thank you for giving to Wisconsin Public Radio during our Giving Tuesday Now. Your generosity keeps us connected with essential news and these thoughtful conversations. If you missed Giving Tuesday Now, there's still time for your gift at WPR.org. And your support, it makes a difference in people's lives every day. Thank you so much. Right now, we're talking about the pandemic, raising concerns about abuse. This is a sensitive discussion, so do please take care. In an extreme case over the weekend, Milwaukee prosecutors charged a man with killing five family members, including four teenagers. And reports say the 43-year-old had a history of domestic violence. What services are most needed to address domestic violence in Wisconsin? Join in with your insights, 800-642-1234. Grisel Santiago-Rivera and Kelly Molitke, they stay with us. They're from End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Grisel, I want to ask about the stability and the wherewithal of your organization first. How has the pandemic affected services that you provide?
Because we are the service provider for the programs that are providing services to victims, we do a lot of training, a lot of assistance, which already was virtual over the phone, via email. But we do a lot of in-person trainings. And those, of course, we are having to move to virtual services. And also we had to modify some of our services to programs recently to go virtual in terms of responding to the pandemic itself. So right now we have modified some of our meetings and trainings to actually talk specifically about this response to the COVID-19 pandemic crisis that we are facing right now.
Have you heard of any shelters having to close due to financial issues or otherwise?
So we have had some shelters who have had to definitely close temporarily, mostly because at least we know of one that had to close because one of the people who was in shelter actually tested positive for the virus. So what shelters are doing for the most part is they are entering into memorandums of understanding with hotels, and they are moving the people who need the shelter to hotels because they have to do deep cleaning of the shelter once somebody has tested positive or somebody has some signs of being ill. And of course, our funders and the funders for the programs, so the state, Department of Children and Families, Department of Justice, have been really graceful in allowing programs to modify some of their budget to cover the cost of having people in hotels rather than shelters. So it has affected the shelters quite a bit, yes.
Kelly, what about for you? How is your organization getting along right now?
Our organization functions very similar to and domestic abuse. So we're able to provide most of what we do remotely, and we had those capabilities prior to the pandemic. So in some ways, that transition was a little easier for us at the statewide level because we're not working directly with survivors. I think that programs are facing more significant challenges as they work to provide the same level of care and services to survivors, but in really different ways during the pandemic.
Are providers and communities, have you noticed where there are more infections? Are they under additional pressures, additional strain?
I think probably everybody is. I think that, we're also balancing that with survivor privacy issues and confidentiality. And so I think, programs are really working within their agencies as well as with community providers, community public health, local public health, to do what's best, not only for survivors, but also for their staff.
Griselle, what about hotline caller volume? Have you seen any changes there during the pandemic?
So a lot of our programs have hotlines, and some of them are reporting an increase in calls, and some of them are reporting a decrease in calls. In some places, of course, more rural places, it is more difficult for people to access when they are at home with the abusive person. Like we spoke at the very beginning of the program, people being isolated and at home with their abusive partners. So it varies. It really depends on each county.
Kelly, can you glean anything from hotline volume?
Yeah, I think the other part that's important to note is the heightened stress and anxiety associated with COVID-19, along with the isolation that accompanies, social distancing, can be triggering and potentially dangerous for survivors. So it's not just folks who are experiencing incidents currently. It is also folks who have experienced violence in the past, and external stresses can heighten anxiety, can trigger some responses for survivors where they may need to seek out services when they haven't received services for weeks, months, even years.
We're talking about domestic abuse and sexual violence during the pandemic, how state groups are responding. We have Kelly Molitke, who's with the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Griselle Santiago Rivera is with End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. With your insights, did you receive help after domestic or sexual abuse? How were you supported? What services did you find most helpful? And how are you today? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Griselle, I want to turn to children for a moment. National groups are saying more children are reported being abused after shelter-in-place orders went into effect. Can you see any uptick there, or what light can you shine?
So we know a few things about child abuse. One of the most important and relevant ones for our work is that there is a lot of child abuse that happens at the intersection of both domestic violence and sexual assault. It's not surprising, though it's very sad, that the number of child abuse cases and calls have increased nationwide. When somebody is in an abusive relationship and children are around, abusers do not take into consideration the fact that there are children around, and that doesn't stop them. And then there's the children who are being abused themselves, who have lost their main point of contact with the outside world, which is usually school. So I think that we are seeing an increase in child abuse cases as well. I think we're going to see much more of it once the safer at home order is lifted, when children and other victims are able to actually have contact again with those resources that they had. And that will create an increase in calls also at the end of this safer at home order.
Oh, you see, as they start to have contact then with the people who were in their lives before and those helpful adults, that then you may see a rise and uptick in reports.
Correct. And that will hold true, I believe, for domestic abuse, for child abuse, and for sexual assault.
Kelly, what do you see there for children in these situations, especially when sexual assault is involved?
Yeah, I will echo lots of what Grisel shared, but we know that children are facing an increased risk for sexual abuse during this time. And we have heard from the National Rape Abuse Incest National Network that they have seen an increase in rates of minors reporting sexual abuse since the shelter in place orders went into effect. And I think it's absolutely true that children do not have other supportive adults that they can access in the same way when they are isolated at home. And we know that the majority of children who are victims of sexual abuse are victimized by a known perpetrator and often somebody from within their family. And so it's a really important issue, and programs I know are already having conversations about how to be ready to respond if there are those increases that we suspect happen when people are able to access services more easily after the stay-at-home orders are lifted.
Kelly, in the meantime, though, what can friends and family do to help?
Yeah, I think there's lots of things that people can do. You know, we can do this for everybody. We can check in on the people in our lives in lots of different ways. We can have, send a text or call people. I know myself and my family and friends are doing meetups through all the different technology that is out there to meet virtually. And I think we can just check in on each other and see how things are going. And as always, when survivors do disclose something, listen to them, believe them, validate them, as well as help them to provide supportive services in their community. So reaching out to a sexual assault service provider in their area or calling a hotline.
Grisel, if home is not a safe place, what can friends, family, neighbors do?
Well, there's a lot of things that can be done. I think there was a campaign going around that I really liked, of, you know, putting notes on your own window saying, if you need help, here I am, here's my phone number. I think it's important, like Kelly said, for family to stay connected as much as possible, and for friends to check on each other. And, you know, obviously technology is one way of doing it, and it's the safest way to do it under the circumstances that we're living in. But there are other ways to do it. It's, you can, like I say, drive by someone's house and, you know, from outside to inside the house, it's a good way to at least see somebody and do things like that. But I also think that it's important that when we are reaching out to people that we, like Kelly said, follow through with a little more assistance, connect them with services as well.
We have to pause right there with Grisel Santiago Rivera and Kelly Mo Litke. We will be back with this conversation in just a moment on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and we're looking at how support networks for survivors of domestic and sexual abuse are responding right now during the pandemic. This is difficult, so do please take care. The National Sexual Assault Hotline reported a surge in reported child abuse after shelter-in-place orders started in March. And then in Milwaukee, advocates and police have reported recent increases in domestic violence compared to last year. Did you receive help after domestic or sexual abuse? How were you supported? What services were most helpful? And where are you today? Still time to share, 800-642-1234. We have Kelly Mo Litke, who is with the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and Grisel Santiago Rivera, who is with End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. We have them for another 10 minutes. Griselle, as we were talking there, how to be the best supporters we can be, whether we're neighbors or loved ones or friends, colleagues at work, you had mentioned driving by and just doing a little check there through the glass. What are other things that people can do to be supportive?
Yes. So like I was saying, you know, and Kelly had mentioned before, phone calls, video calls, and, you know, making yourself available and making sure that you convey to your friends, family members, that if they are experiencing some situation, that they can reach out to you and what the best way to do that would be. And I think as coworkers also, you know, we spend a lot of time with the people that we work with. So being able to connect with people at work is super important, especially if people are working from home. There are different ways to connect that way. And as the last point I was trying to make is that also making sure that you, if you're providing support to someone, that you are aware of what agencies are in your area that can assist that person.
Yeah, so do a little education as an advocate or just to have some information that you can maybe just pass along to that person.
Correct.
Kelly, I want to look for a moment at the state prison population. The ACLU is calling for state and local authorities to reduce prison and jail populations due to the pandemic. How do you feel about that position?
Well, first of all, our understanding is that release is focused on nonviolent offenders, meaning it would not likely impact victims of abuse. And so therefore, we would support these efforts to release individuals, both from a public health perspective, but also from an anti-oppression standpoint.
What special considerations would you like lawmakers to be thinking about during the review of domestic abuse or, in your case, sexual assault cases, Kelly?
You know, maybe there's opportunities to connect with victims in cases. And again, you know, I think a lot of the release efforts are focused on nonviolent offenders. But in cases where there are victims, you know, getting victim impact statements and feedback from survivors when decisions are being made.
Griselle, are you watching this? And if so, what do you make of it in terms of your position in domestic abuse? Are you concerned that someone will be released from prison and continue the cycle?
Well, we have some concerns. Now, our organization, End Abuse, we are working towards ending violence and building safer communities for everybody. And we acknowledge that there are perpetrators of violence in all of our communities. Survivors live in fear. But we also know that, like Kelly mentioned, the prison system, it has a disproportionate impact on certain communities, including communities of color. I think that there's a concern, but I also think that End Abuse actually supports a decrease in the prison population. But I want to make it clear, this is not, I don't think we have a one-size-fits-all approach that would work to this. I think that even though they're talking about releasing nonviolent offenders, a lot of people plea down from a violent offense to a nonviolent offense. So I think that we need a thoughtful process that really is designed to release those who pose no threat to the community.
Griselle, I know that you work and see so many programs in action that are trying to end domestic violence. How do we break the cycle? What programs are most effective?
I think breaking the cycle it's a multifaceted approach, right? We need prevention, and that usually comes in the form of education, and educating teens and our younger generations is key. Obviously, we need intervention while violence is happening. So we need the advocates that are going to respond to the crisis. And then we need healing on the back end for both the abused person, so the victim, the survivor, and for the perpetrator.
And do you feel like all of those support systems are in place, that you are able to provide those supports and services for victims?
I think we have most of them in place. I think that during this pandemic, some of those services, because they are looking different, the reach of those services is a little different, and we are still trying to figure out how to make sure that those services continue to be provided to everybody that needs them.
Kelly, how about for you? What services are absolutely critical in moving the needle and reducing sexual assault in our communities?
Yeah, I think it's important that everybody in all communities acknowledge that we all have a role in ending sexual violence. And it's not just those of us that are working in the field and working to end violence. So everybody can get involved, whether that means supporting survivors in your life, speaking up when you hear inappropriate comments like victim blaming, and also because we know we won't end sexual violence without ending all forms of oppression. We also have to get involved in efforts working against racism, homophobia, and other forms of oppression. And so it's going to take everybody doing things both individually in their community, as well as lawmakers and policy makers, a multifaceted approach, as Griselle mentioned, to really start to move that needle and work to prevent sexual violence.
We were talking there with Kelly Molitke, the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and Griselle Santiago Rivera with End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. Griselle, as we start to close here, I'm wondering, what is the most challenging aspect of your work and what keeps you going? Because this is really difficult.
I think the most challenging aspect of our work is the psychological toll that it takes on all of the people who are helping victims. A lot of advocates may have been victims themselves in the past, maybe survivors. Even if you have never experienced domestic violence, day in and day out, listening to people's stories can be very, very challenging. I always, whenever I get asked the question of why do you keep doing this, I always say, you know, when you get that one person who looks at you and says to you, thank you, in a very, very genuine way, you understand what that thank you means, right? Thank you because you saved my life. Thank you because you made my life better. Thank you because you made me a better parent. Thank you because now my children will thrive. That is enough to keep, I think, any of us going.
Kelly, how about you?
That was great, Griselle. I would just also add that I really believe in prevention. Like, I really believe that our efforts do work. And while it takes us some time to see the outcomes of those efforts, I really believe that that sexual violence and domestic violence are preventable. And there are things that we are doing that are having an impact and that are helping to keep people safe. And so I think that's keeping an eye on the prevention piece and really know that we can create social change to end sexual violence.
Well, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Kelly Molitke, Associate Director of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and Griselle Santiago Rivera, Interim Executive Director of End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. Here are resources to help. The National Domestic Violence Hotline. This is the number, 800-799-7233. That's 800-799-SAFE. Or the National Sexual Assault Hotline is this number, 800-656-4673. That's 800-656-HOPE. And you can find these resources at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.